history of the Tribune. It's now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Art McDonald, who I haven't seen for a number of years, but it is good to see you again.
Indeed.
I just want to read a bit, just to give you an introduction. Art is the director of the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory, and he discovered that neutrinos have mass and that they can change from one type of neutrino to another, which I didn't know. And by the way, for those of you who care, I said I used to be Minister of Science and Technology. I'm not a Minister of Tourism, Sport, and the Arts. And if you wonder how that happens, because I actually prefer science and technology, but you're at the whatever the Premier asked you to do, that's what you do. So this is actually my 10th ministry, which is a record in the province of British Columbia. No other politician. So I just want to continue this about art. Some academics quietly wind down their careers as they near retirement. Not Arthur McDonald. Particle astrophysics experiments have been the motivation for his research for many years, and he's not about to leave the exciting work now. In 1984, McDonald became part of an ambitious physics experiment that would hopefully take place in Canada. The project was counterintuitive. They would measure mysterious solar particles from the bottom of a mine. Now, here's what Eric says about Art McDonald. Art McDonald grew up in Cape Breton, where everyone has the name of McDonald. Even his wife was a McDonald. And he had a career at Chalk River and then at Princeton, from where he returned to Canada to lead the neutrino experiment at Sudbury, where deep underground they carried out the epoch-making experiment which solved the mystery of the neutrinos from the sun. Is this the same sort of thing we looked at in Italy when we went into the middle of that mountain?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. See, I did learn. It's done me well in tourism. Using Canada's unique supply of heavy water, they were able to show that the neutrinos from the sun, after leaving the very hot core of the sun where they were created, partly changed from the electron neutrinos to which form they were created into muon neutrinos. This explained why the previous experiments over several decades, which had searched for electron neutrinos from the sun, always found that they were down in number by a factor of about 2 from what they should have been detected. The whole world was relieved. And this result went beyond Carlos. Well, we got some competition here. Standard model of building blocks and forces. Because of Art and his colleagues, the sun will continue to shine. Art, welcome.
Eric, would you like to guess what my mother-in-law's name was before she married
McDonald? Yeah, I know.
Except that they're still different. The difference, it turns out, between McDonald, a small d, and McDonald.
So that was a mixed marriage.
Yeah, so as my wife says, no relatives. No relation. However, it's difficult to be friends. It really is an honor for me to be here today and to be speaking about Eric and to do so at this symposium that discusses his many accomplishments and his contributions to Canadian science.
Do you want me to put that
And what I'd like to talk about at the very beginning is a bit of my experience with Eric, because really Eric has been one of the premier and most respected Canadian scientists essentially for my entire career. I started in nuclear physics in the late 1960s, went to Chalk River where he was a legend, and he was here at Triumph and already working his magic in various ways to make this laboratory the premier national and international laboratory in subatomic physics in Canada, but also a very substantial laboratory internationally, as Nigel has told you. I can still remember Eric, the theorist, coming to Chalk River, and I asked him this morning about exactly when this was, but I think it's 1973, and giving us a talk, and it was always an exciting time when Eric came. It was always the latest science that was being discussed. But this time, Eric was telling us about working shifts, shimming the magnet on Triumph. This was 1973, and he already was firmly into this process of doing things around Triumph because he was passionately interested in the science that could come from that. And he went on from that to develop the laboratory, as Nigel has told you. I can remember coming to Triumph successively over the years and observing how it was being transformed, particularly during the years that Eric was the director. And it's just as Nigel said, it went from a national local laboratory, really, to being an international laboratory. And it was the force of Eric's personality in many ways that resulted in that transition. It was his breadth of perspective. It was his always dreaming the dreams that people in many cases didn't dare to dream that resulted in the perspective that developed around Triumph. For someone coming from outside to Triumph over those years, it really was a very pleasant experience, particularly as a Canadian coming to Triumph and feeling, boy, there's something really good that's happening in my country, and we are really getting on the international scene because of the way this laboratory is being developed. In addition to that, there was the personal aspect. Eric was very gracious to everyone who visited. You really felt like you wanted to come back. He and Barbara would entertain people at their home, and it really, you felt as though you were a part of this great thing that was happening here. And I really want to compliment you on what you've done here. It really has been transformed into a laboratory, which is something that Canadians can be very proud of, both nationally and internationally. Your perspective on having people work not only at home but also elsewhere is something that I'm going to speak about in some detail from now on. I'm going to talk about the relationship between Triumph and SNOW and what will be an ongoing relationship between Triumph and SNOW Lab and UBC as well in that context. And that perspective, I think, is one of the things that led to the internationalization of Triumph at a time when that was very appropriate to be happening. And it's something also that we've benefited from greatly at the SNOW project and now with SNOW Lab. I also remember, I mean, talking about Eric as a teacher, and I will mention a couple of, I'll give a couple of quotations from people who've been involved in the SNOW project who were first year students here at UBC and actually took their first year course from Eric. But I can remember Eric coming to Princeton when I was there in the 1980s as the director of our external review committee. And it was really a very positive experience for us. Eric went at it in his usual thorough way, but one of the things that he went out of his way to do was to talk with the students. The students were very important to him. He talked to the undergraduates, he talked to the graduates, and he asked them how well their education was being provided to them in the department. And then he told us what he learned from them. And I thought to myself, it's very characteristic of how Eric does things. He thinks about the students. He thinks about the question of whether they're getting the education that they should be getting when it comes to review a project. And so I think it's entirely appropriate that the effort that you're putting forward, Jess, is in terms of support for first year students who Eric has taught over many years. I even picked up the latest issue of the Canadian Undergraduate Physics Journal and found an article in here about the SNOW project by a first-year physics student at UBC, and acknowledgements. I would like to thank Dr. Eric Vogt first for the support in terms of that sort of research project that that the student was doing. So I'm going to talk now about the connections between Triumph and UBC and SNOW and in the future SNOW Lab. But I want you all to realize that this is being done in the context of things that Eric put in motion here at Triumph that enabled these sorts of interactions between Triumph as a national and really international laboratory and our project. And we hope that, in fact, that will continue for the future projects. So let me just show you the list of names of people over the years who have been involved in various ways here at Triumph and at UBC in the SNOW project, and it's a large number of people. It's involving faculty members and Triumph scientists and postdocs and grad students and undergraduates as well. There's a large number of undergraduates that are represented there, and I'd like to thank particularly Chris and Rich and Scott for their help in compiling some of the information that I'm going to show you as we go forward. So let me first tell you a bit about the science associated with the SNOW project. As was said, we started out in the 1980s with a situation where neutrinos that were being produced by the nuclear reactions that power the sun were being measured by a series of experiments that had different energy thresholds and therefore different sensitivities to the different principal reactions that powered the sun, which are listed over here. And what you see is the combination of reactions that you might expect to be producing numbers of neutrinos. And what you see in the blue bars is, on the same scale in each case, the number that were observed by Ray Davis's chlorine experiment, by the experiments initiated by Koshiba in Japan, Kamiokande and Super K, and by the gallium experiments. And they were all falling short of the mark. And the question that was being asked is whether this was because the models of the sun were incorrect, or whether there was something happening to the neutrinos, such as changing from the type produced in the core of the sun, which are exclusively electron neutrinos, to other types before they reached these detectors, which were primarily or exclusively sensitive to electron neutrinos. And so we started out with heavy water, and it's a credit to people like George Yoon and Herb Chen that they had the guts to go and try to do this with borrowing $300 million worth of Canadian heavy water in order to do something very specific in physics. And if you are able to get the heavy water, 1,000 tons as was obtained, then it's possible to measure two types of reactions simultaneously. One, which is very specific to the type of neutrinos that are produced in the core of the sun. These are observed by a burst of light when they change a neutron into a proton and a fast-moving electron, and a second reaction that is sensitive equally to all neutrino types, which basically just breaks apart that deuteron into a neutron and a proton, and it is that neutron that you eventually detect. We did that in three different ways. If you look at the ratio of those two, then if in fact you find that all of the neutrinos are not electron neutrinos, in other words, if the ratio of this reaction to that reaction is less than one, then you have clear evidence, assuming you can do it accurately enough, that neutrinos have changed from one flavor to the other, and you can resolve the question that was a fairly fundamental one. It's important as a measure not only of what's happening in the sun, which is important, because you want to understand whether the models are right, but it's also important because the standard model that places neutrinos along with electrons and quarks and other particles in the basic model at that point for elementary particles predicted that in fact they do not change their flavor, do not change from one type to the other. And so you'd be pushing on beyond that model if in fact you were to observe this, as we did. And in addition to that, it has turned out that the only real model that works is one in which neutrinos have a mass which is finite, and which is greater than zero, in other words, which also was a postulate of the standard model, that they were, that it was zero, in fact. And so we've learned things about particle physics which also have impact in the early universe. There's another reaction that we observe as well, but which was similar to what was observed in the light water. With this reaction, you do have sensitivity to all types as well as electron neutrinos, but it's difficult to sort out which it is that you are observing. I'll come back to that later. We went through three phases in the experiment. In the first case, we simply used pure heavy water, and we detected that neutron by observing a gamma ray that is produced when the neutron recaptures in deuterium. Then we enhanced our sensitivity. You'll notice the efficiency goes up significantly. When you put a pinch of salt, a couple of tons of salt in the heavy water, AACL was a little bit worried about whether we could get it out again, but we assured them that we could, and by gosh, they believed us, thank goodness, and it turned out to be a very successful measurement. Those two have been reported. You'll notice that we went on to a third phase, which finished at the end of 2006. We are in the process of analyzing the data from this final phase of the experiment. In fact, Scott and Blair Jameson and a variety of us have been on the phone almost constantly the last while. We're very close to having that analysis complete. And it is an independent measurement of that neutron reaction in which you put an array, about 400 meters of ultra-low radioactivity neutron detectors in the heavy water, and you observe explicitly the capture of the neutron on helium-3. And so we have three different ways of doing it. The reason for doing it various ways is to be sure you've got it right, but it's also to try to improve your accuracy as you go along. So what did we do? We took this $300 million worth of heavy water on loan for a buck, which is pretty good leverage in anybody's economy, I guess. But you have to be careful, and you also have to pay for insurance for it, about $1 million a year. But anyway, we were careful, and we were able, as it turns out, to hand it all back without any significant loss at all. And you put it in the middle of an acrylic sphere, which is 12 meters in diameter and about 5 centimeters thick. Really a bubble of acrylic, but a solid one. You suspend the whole thing in water, ultra-pure light water, a total of 7,000 tons, and you put 9,500 sensitive light sensors looking in at the light that's produced by these reactions. They were made significantly more sensitive by adding light collectors, as they're called, and I'll talk to that a little bit later. Chris Waltham and his group here at UBC were very principal developers of those light collectors for the experiment. You put it all a couple of kilometers down in the Creighton mine, which INCO was nice enough to allow us to use. A very active mine, it's still one of their most productive mines, where they're taking about 5,000 tons of ore a day out of the mine as we're doing our work, which is an advantage to us because they maintain all their safety systems and everything else. We don't have to do that, and we get it essentially at a bargain. But the cooperation of INCO, it's now Valley INCO as it's called, has been fantastic over the years, and it extends to the development of the laboratory that I'll talk about at the end, where we've expanded the region underground. We were very concerned about radioactivity because it turns out that second reaction, the one where you can break deuterium apart into a neutron, and it is the neutron that gives you the measure of whether a neutrino has been observed, can also happen due to radioactivity. And so we had to control the radioactivity to a tremendous degree. We were able to do that to the point that the heavy water in the middle of the detector had less than one radioactive decay per day per ton of heavy water. From uranium and thorium, which were the things that could cause a problem in this reaction. That was accomplished, it was measured, and so we were able essentially to measure neutrinos and almost nothing but, and essentially no radioactive background in the sample that we were using. We did that also by making this essentially the entire detector, in fact the entire laboratory, by the way, the scale of this is a person, and this is about 34 meters high, so it's the size of a 10-story building, roughly speaking. We made the whole laboratory a clean room, as we're doing with the new laboratory, and so by doing so, we were able to control all the mine dust that otherwise gives us problems in terms of our measurements, particularly that radioactive reaction that produces the neutron. It's now all, the heavy water's been returned safely, and we're on to the next stage, and I'll tell you about that later. This is what it looked like during construction. We had to put together the different layers that I showed you in that previous piece or picture, part by part. You can see the light sensors that look in at this inner acrylic sphere, last bit of the sphere being constructed. This is what it looked like after the sphere was constructed. You see the photomultipliers and Chris and his team's light collectors. You see people in ultra-clean clothing. you see now the whole thing closed up and ready to observe the neutrinos when they come. Everybody takes a shower and changes their clothing when they come into the laboratory. So we're over 70,000 showers now, and we have a really clean laboratory. My mother, who visited, absolutely wouldn't believe that I could be responsible for something like that, but sure enough, it actually happened. This shows a couple of the UBC graduate students, Christian Nally and Jared Heise, during the detector construction. These people were very actively involved in the actual construction, many years of construction, many things to get worked out. You see them there. Jarrett went on to be our detector operations manager in future years. We gave the students a full experience, and they performed extremely well. And speaking of people who have been very active in the laboratory and who have an association with Eric and UBC, the next detector operations manager was the one before Jarrett was Fraser Duncan, who then moved on to be deputy director of the project, and he's now associate director of Snow Lab. And along with Dave Sinclair, who's actually also a Triumph research scientist at Carleton, they really developed the new laboratory I'll tell you about. But I presume you can read this, but Fraser wants to pass on his best wishes to Eric. He remembers this room, he says, is the first room he walked into for his first lecture about 28 years ago here at UBC. He says, I remember apples levitating. And I asked Eric at the beginning, what did that mean? And he said, oh, I wanted to catch their attention with respect to F equals MA. So I got someone to drop an apple from the top there, splat, down on the floor. I got their attention. And so you can understand the sort of reasons why people like Fraser and Axel Helin, who has really been one of the leaders of SNOW throughout and is now a Tier 1 Canada Research Chair in Alberta, say that Eric is very approachable and really enjoyed students. You can also see that someone who has a conversation with Eric about the possibility of going to Princeton as a graduate student might possibly end up there, which is what, in fact, Axel did. So Eric's influence on students is very clear over the years, and they end up, in this case, taking very responsible roles. Here's someone as a student, someone who some of you may know now as a more mature individual. In fact, he's the analysis coordinator for this current phase, the neutral current detector phase of SNOW. That's Alan Poon, and he was working with Chris at the time. You'll see one of the light collectors here and the process of studying the reflection from those light collectors was going on here at UBC. You see that each phototube is surrounded by these petals of light collecting material. And this is actually what you see if you poke a very wide angle camera up in the bottom of SNOW. You see the actual acrylic sphere and you see the light collection. Basically, there's about a 20% probability of seeing a single photon when it's emitted in the center of the detector. Now, Triumph and particularly Rich Helmer were very actively involved in many other ways in the development of SNOW. The parts of the detector were designed and built here. At Triumph, this is what's called a wiffle tree. It's a load balancing device for the ropes that hold the acrylic vessel in place. This is the what we call the glove box and the devices for putting in a clean way for putting calibration sources down into the middle of the detector. This is right over the chimney and the heavy water is down here, and this is where you put the calibration devices in. The electronics, tremendous amount of work done here at Triumph, overseen by Rich and staff and by students in testing the electronics in the first place as we were preparing to start the detector. And Rich came to Sudbury and acted as the commissioning manager to get the detector going in the first place. And we benefited greatly from the capabilities that could be brought to this activity here at Triumph. In addition to this, Rich was responsible for making it possible for us to use a source where lithium-8 nuclei were produced by bombarding boron by with neutrons, a little underground neutron generator, and transporting it to the center of the detector through a capillary tube. Again, working with students, and making it possible for us to observe, this is something that's proportional to the energy of the event. And this is what neutrinos interacting by that first reaction, the electron neutrino sensitive reaction, looked like, or what we expect them to look like in terms of numbers of events versus numbers of photomultiplier tubes hit, which is really the amount of energy deposited in the detector. And you see that lithium-8, which is this pink data here, is very similar in its shape, and that's because they're the analog nucleus. And so it was a very nice measurement to have, particularly because these are actual electrons that are producing this light. In addition to that, we had the calibration device that Alan Poon built, which was producing high-energy gamma rays by protons bombarding a tritium target in a situation where he built a compact source that could actually be suspended in the middle of snow and run to produce the calibration. And all of that led to our ability to calibrate to within about 1.5% throughout the detector volume. And so the contributions were substantial, and this is in addition to contributions that we had from people like Jean-Michel and Ewart, who served on our advisory committees over many years, and others from TRIOMF as well, which were extremely valuable to us as we were dealing with the development of the project. So the final results obtained from this neutrinos and essentially nothing but neutrinos data, after the salt phase is shown here, we were able to determine that the numbers of neutrinos detected by the charge current reaction, and therefore representing electron neutrinos, divided by the numbers of neutrinos detected by the all neutrino type, all three neutrino types, was 0.34 plus or minus uncertainties that made it clear that there's no way this could be one. There's no way that you could have no change of flavor from electron neutrinos to other types. In fact, the electron neutrinos are only about a third of the total, which is just what you would have expected if, in fact, what was happening was they were changing their type. It also meant, in fact, that the total number of neutrinos being produced in the sun is very close to what's predicted by the solar models. And in fact, you can see that comparison here. Here's the total number of neutrinos being produced, and here are the calculations of solar models, very much in agreement within the uncertainties. And in fact, these measurements are better than the uncertainties in the theory now. This shows you, if you do a plot of the various reactions and their sensitivities, where you're plotting the numbers of mu and tau neutrinos on this axis and the numbers of electron neutrinos here, that the numbers of mu and tau neutrinos are not zero. In fact, they're greater than zero by about 7 standard deviations. Very clearly, flavor change. Now, we now have neutrinos changing their flavor. Here, for many of you in the audience, this is too many equations. I apologize, but let me try to at least set the context for where the physics is, because by doing this, maybe I can at least point you to some of the other things we hope to measure. If you have neutrinos changing their flavor and they have a mass, and in fact, this really seems to be the only explanation for the major effect that's happening. There could be other things contributing at a subdominant level, but if neutrinos have mass, then it is not necessarily the case that the electron mu and tau neutrinos are 1-to-1 in their identification with mass 1, 2, and 3. There could be a matrix relationship here. There could be that electron neutrinos are partly mass 1, partly mass 2, and partly mass 3. This matrix has come to be known as the Maki-Nakagawa-Sakata-Fontecorvo, or MNSP matrix, and it takes this form, which in fact can be broken down into various components. For neutrino oscillations, everything to the left, for neutrino flavor change, everything to the left is relevant, and they're broken down into things that can be tested with different experiments. In fact, the first evidence that in fact neutrinos were changing their flavor came from atmospheric neutrino measurements made at Super Kamiokande in Japan, the same detector that is being used by the T2K experiment that Nigel mentioned earlier. Subsequently, we were able to show, that was a disappearance experiment, we were able to show clearly that it was due to, for solar neutrinos, due to flavor change, due to oscillation, due to massive neutrinos, and that was confirmed thereafter by the Camland experiment using reactor neutrinos. And in both the case of mass 1 and 2, which is relevant here, and 2, 3, which is relevant here, we now know differences in mass. Now the future, the T2K experiment primarily will attempt to understand that component, for which we have a limit, but not a number as yet. And the hope is to understand this CP violating phase, or this term which is related to matter-antimatter asymmetry in our universe. And this is a matter of significant interest because, in fact, we don't know how it is that we started out with the original Big Bang, producing essentially equal amounts of matter and antimatter, and somehow right now we find ourselves in a universe where all the antimatter has decayed away, and you don't see little bursts of positron annihilation happening before your eyes all the time in this universe. There's very little antimatter left. One way in which you can do it is with these accelerator experiments. Carla will also talk about the objectives of such experiments in the future, and it's ultimately attempting to determine this term. What I will talk about a little later is the fact that these same numbers, which you can extract from the information you obtained from the experiments done so far, are used to influence a process called neutrinoless double beta decay, with a couple of more parameters that come in there, which also could be related to this original matter-antimatter asymmetry in the universe, usually referred to as leptogenesis. And so we have an objective of studying this. There's another effect that can happen. What I was showing you there is neutrinos propagating or traveling in a vacuum. If you have a very high density of electrons, such as you have in the sun, you can have additional interactions that affect the neutrinos, and you can have them affected as they go through the sun. They appear to be, from our measurements. You could have them affected as they go through the Earth. This is something that Scott Oser has studied in great detail with others for the SNOW project. And this will also be an objective for the future experiments, T2K and successors, because we know from what we've seen for the sun that mass 2 is greater than mass 1. It turns out the only thing that works, if you put together all the solar data, is a set of parameters here for this angle theta 1, 2, and for the difference in mass relevant to that. The only thing that works is a situation where there is interaction with the electrons in the sun and mass 2 is greater than mass 1. That will be explored for mass 2 and 3 in the future. The other thing that you see from this data is that clearly, to about 5 standard deviations, this angle is less than tan squared theta 1, 2 is equal to 1, which is what some of the theories have put forward. And so we're defining what the parameters are that the theories have to match when you go beyond the standard model. And a lot of what we're trying to do with the future measurements with SNOW and other things is to pin those numbers down even more so that when you want to understand the standard, what goes beyond the standard model, you have the data very accurately. Now, as I said, Scott and his students have shown that there's a very small effect interaction in the Earth, and that has figured in our ability to define this region of acceptability. Now, shortly after SNOW results came out, the Camland experiment using reactor neutrinos in Japan came up with results which originally were not as well defined as this, but which overlapped this region very well. Their latest data is extremely good in defining things on this mass axis, and our data, basically the ratio of charge to neutral current, defines things very well on this axis. So they're very complementary in their contributions. Other things that have been studied, and again, Scott and his students have been very front and center in this study, is whether we can study the neutrinos produced in the, whether we can observe for the neutrinos produced in the core of the sun, whether there's any variation with time. And in fact, nothing has been observed with a sensitivity for an oscillation on the order of 8 to 10%, ranging over a period from one day to 10 years, and that's being pushed even further as we go forward. Chris and his students, and this is an ongoing activity, have been studying atmospheric neutrinos. We haven't published on this as yet because, in fact, we don't have as much sensitivity as Supercamiocanda does because it's a much bigger detector in their case, and the heavy water doesn't give us an advantage. However, we can, being deep under a flat plane, look above the horizon, and so the relationship between this and this will be of significance when we do publish that in the future. Jared Heise, who did his thesis here at UBC, did it on the basis of our ability to observe supernova, and I'll mention that later in connection with an experiment that Stan Yen is involved in. But Jared has also been instrumental in connecting us into a network of supernova detectors that can tell the astronomers where to go and look, and that, or at least that a supernova is taking place. Because in fact, neutrinos you observe long before the light curve, before the light begins to develop from the supernova, and so that's of significant interest. The final phase of the project, as I said before, is putting about 400 meters of ultra-low radioactivity neutron detectors in the heavy water. A lot of the students had great fun flying a remotely operated submarine in this $300 million worth of heavy water. We discovered very quickly that there's no point in trying to get anybody who's older than about 20 trying to run this thing because they're just the wrong generation. They're going to mess up completely, much to the frustration of some of the people who were over 20 who figured they could do it. But the students did a fantastic job. They installed all these 400 meters of neutron detectors with this submarine and then unhooked them all later and took them out, and then we returned the heavy water. Those detectors, as it turns out, are a part of that experiment that I mentioned that Stan is involved in. And recycling, of course, and sustainability is all the rage these days, and I'll show you how they are being reused in the future generation. Using these neutron detectors gives us the ability to make a measurement in a completely different way, completely independent of the charge current reaction, no correlations between these measurements and the measurements of the charge current. The blind analysis is almost complete, and in fact, this is what you see when you look at the neutron signal from that array of detectors. There's extra stuff added in, so they can't determine quantitatively what the answer is, but this is what it looks like in terms of the neutrons capturing in helium-3 sitting on a background of alpha particles. Now that looks like a big background, but in fact, this is one count every 2 hours in 400 meters of detector. And so these detectors were really made ultra-low in radioactivity. And by doing pulse-shaped discrimination, you can reduce this even further. And again, as I mentioned, Scott and Claire Jameson are very actively involved in this phase of the experiment. And we're pushing on, looking at the previous data, and we will have more accurate results from it as well as we study it in more detail. So in terms of the SNOW, we are just about finished in terms of this phase of the project. There are four or five other papers that are very actively being pursued over the next year or year and a half in order to complete the project. But now let me move on to the future, again with Triumph involvement. The future is the development of an underground facility which will be available in terms of the new parts starting this year. David Sinclair and Fraser Duncan have been very actively involved in the development work I'm going to tell you about for the laboratory itself. David, of course, is a Triumph research scientist half-time at Carleton University. What we will study is things that benefit from this very deep, very clean environment we've been able to develop. We're the deepest laboratory in the world by a substantial factor in terms of the total number of muons interacting with our detector, which is because of our great depth and the fact that we're under a flat plane. We have a laboratory that now has been expanded from the original area involving SNOW, which is this area here. There's the SNOW detector, and it will be used for SNOW Plus in the future. By building another area over here involving basically three new areas, an area here we refer to as the ladder labs for the geometry of them, and two larger cavities, one which is called the cube hall and one which is a cryopit, which for cryogenic experiments, at least one class of cryogenic experiments, you would think of housing them in this particular location. And the status is that everything essentially is complete in terms of excavation now for these new areas. This is just about finished in terms of finishing the walls, and these, the walls have been painted and they're in the process of starting to put in the services like air conditioning and so on. And therefore, basically this new area is ready for occupancy. This shows you the size of that cube hall. It's about, I think, 65 feet high, something like that, and it will house several experiments in the future, as I'll show you. We've had a lot of international interest in SNOLAB. We have letters of interest or intent from a variety of different experiments. Stu Smith's the chairman of our experiments evaluation committee, and the red here implies that they have been finally approved for siting in SNOLAB. I'll speak about several of them, depending on how the time goes. I'm getting close to the end, and I'll see how much I can tell you about experiments that are looking at dark matter. I'll tell you a bit more about that in a moment. This phenomenon of neutrinoless double beta decay that I mentioned earlier, Snow Plus and EXO in particular. We will have future capabilities for solar neutrinos with Snow Plus, as well as neutrinos from the Earth, and supernova. And I'll tell you in particular about the HALO experiment that Stan Yen is involved in. Snow Plus will also have some supernova capability. So let me start with dark matter. Well, we know from a wide variety of different experiments, both particle physics and astrophysics and astronomical measurements, that the universe is really, well, we know a lot about the way the universe is composed, except we don't know what the things are that make up the different components of which it is composed. In fact, we know that there's a large fraction of the universe that is being referred to as dark energy. Exactly what it is not known, but we know that it has been influencing the universe's expansion as measured by supernova at very large distances. We also know that the matter that we're made of is a very small fraction of the total type of matter that we are composed of, neutrons, protons, electrons, all of those things. And we also know that there is a significant part of the universe that is made of particles that are not like us, probably particles that were produced in the original Big Bang, maybe produced again, maybe next year at the Large Hadron Collider. They could potentially be the so-called supersymmetric particles that would be perhaps produced there for the first time because we now have the energy to produce them, but they're also capable of being observed because they go through us in enormous numbers, as neutrinos from the sun do, and they can produce little bursts of light the same way the neutrinos from the sun can, if you pick your materials properly and if you get your radioactivity levels away down. We know now that neutrinos are only a few percent of this dark matter. We weren't sure when we started out on SNOW that that was the case, but now we're looking for other things. Weakly interacting massive particles, such as the lightest neutral supersymmetric particle that is the next level of unification above the Standard Model, or one possibility for it. So how do you do these experiments? Well, not so different from SNOW, actually. You collect the right type of material, in this case, liquid argon. This is one example of a liquid argon experiment that's being pursued at SNOLAB. Carlo is pursuing, along with his team, a slightly different approach to it, but with the same.
I've been doing it for 20 years.
So. Sure, right. He's been in liquid argon for many, many years, and the identification of liquid argon as a good thing to use for observing WIMPs or dark matter particles is something that we have in common, and the techniques in part are the same. The approach that is being taken in Canada is to recognize that if you have a nuclear recoil, then you have a very short pulse typically, or at least very little in terms of the long greater than 20 or 30 nanosecond part of a pulse. Whereas if you have electrons from gammas or betas, then you get quite a large tail from effects that happen in the emission of the light. And so two collaborations, the deep and the clean collaborations, have come together to try to take advantage of this. If you just look at the short to long pulse as an identifier, here is what you see for 10 to the 8th nuclear recoils, 10 to the 8th gamma rays or beta rays, and here's what you see for weakly interacting massive particles. This collaboration then is pursuing this. Two stages, a 360 kilogram total mass detector, of which about 100 in the middle will be the so-called fiducial volume, the radiation-free region, and then a second stage, larger scale detector. The idea is phototubes looking in at a central region. They would be housed side by side in the cube hall, and the shielding and so on for both of them would probably be created over the next year, so that it's possible to go in two stages. We've been running a 7 kilogram version of this. We have discrimination against the background that happens in argon, which is argon 39, produced in the atmosphere, a beta decaying radioactivity, demonstrated by running on the surface with 7 kilograms at 6 × 10⁻¹. We want to get to about 10⁻⁹ for the larger detectors. We think, in fact, that we can get there, and we'll be. We've now taken this detector underground, and it, hopefully within the next few months we'll have that demonstration. However, it's possible also to use depleted argon, for which sources have been observed now with a depletion of a factor of 20 or so. The reason why we're interested is that with this large amount of liquid argon, up to a ton of liquid argon, you can go several orders of magnitude below the sensitivity of current experiments looking for these dark matter particles, where here you're looking at the probability of observing a particle versus its mass, and hopefully get there starting somewhere around 2010. Double beta decay, as I mentioned earlier, what you see in double beta decay is influenced by that same matrix, the MNSP matrix, for which parameters have been defined by the measurements done so far and will be defined by future measurements, plus a couple of other parameters. It also depends on what comes out of this. Is mass 3 greater than or less than the other masses? And so the sensitivity you can get depends upon that, and there's also a degree of uncertainty due to those parameters. However, the present experiments are up in this region. We hope in the next generation to get down to from about 0.3 electron volts down to about 0.04 electron volts. And we were extremely pleased to observe that if you do something quite minimal to the snow detector, you can actually do that. And the thing to do is to put in liquid scintillator, which gives you about, greater than 40 times more light output from the central region. It's lighter than water, and therefore it floats up rather than having to be held up as the heavy water detector was, with these ropes with their Triumph-produced wiffle trees up at the top. If you put a series of ropes over the top and hold it down, it looks as though, and there's been finite element calculations being done by Van Strickland at Carleton, it looks as though we should be able to do that, and then we just have to change our purification system to purify the scintillator rather than water, and otherwise the detector essentially runs as it has before. And so we're able to get into the game of double beta decay in about 2010 with quite respectable amounts of this particular isotope, neodymium-150. If you put in a ton of neodymium, you don't affect your light output significantly. You get 56 kilograms of neodymium. That's similar to what other people are doing in other experiments. And there is the prospect of being able to enhance that by a factor of 10, because there's now been agreement not to shut down a uranium laser isotope separation facility in France, but instead to there's a study going on about retooling it to do neodymium separation. And so the possibility is there of getting maybe half a ton of enriched isotope at some point in the future. And so that's the primary effort for SNOW Plus as we go forward. And if you got that half a ton, and if the
neutrino mass, effective neutrino mass, was a factor of two smaller than the present limit, this is what you would see. That would be fondest dreams in terms of our experiment, but you clearly have sensitivity. These are the suggestions for the ultimate sensitivity after a few years of running in natural neodymium or enriched neodymium. We're in the ballpark we would like to get for the next generation experiments. And this is, of course, of relevance to this question of matter-antimatter asymmetry, as well as the question of whether a neutrino is its own antiparticle. So let me finish up by discussing very briefly a couple of other potential experiments. One is one that San Yan has been working on along with Clarence Virtue and others from Laurentian. It's a reuse of the neutron detectors from SNOW with about 80 tons of existing lead. Lead has a very nice property that it is predominantly electron neutrino sensitive in the event of a supernova. Other detectors are more sensitive to other neutrino types, and one of the things you'd like to understand, if you're lucky enough to have a supernova go off in the center of your galaxy, which happens maybe once every 30 years, if you're lucky enough to have it happen, then you can make a tremendous diagnosis of what's happening in this supernova. And apropos ISAC, the fact that essentially all the elements heavier than iron are produced in supernova means that we have something in common in attempting to understand these events, in our case by observing the neutrinos, hopefully in the future. The other thing that is being studied in the way of double beta decay is the decay of xenon with the electrons going to a detector in this direction and the barium that is produced being drifted to a region where it can be studied with lasers and observed to fluoresce. The observation of fluorescence for barium is already in place, and various work on R&D for doing this in gas has been taking place at Carleton and Laurentian. This is another potential future experiment, again involving David Sinclair. And finally, there's another technique involved with the Picasso experiment where using a spin-dependent interaction for observing dark matter, it's possible to get very sensitive limits on dark matter particles which might be interacting by a spin-dependent interaction by observing bubbles that are produced in a supersaturated gel due to a nuclear recoil. And they are up to the point of running about 2.5 kilograms over this year. They observe the events by seeing the sound that's made when such an event takes place. And so finally, just to reiterate, what I told you about is a whole variety of partnerships that have taken place in the past between TRIOMPHE and SNOW, and which will be taking place in the future between SNOW Lab and TRIOMPHE. There are lots of discussions about the engineering possibilities with TRIOMPHE acting as a national lab in support of the experiments that we're developing, which we're extremely pleased about. But of course, Eric, in turning this laboratory into what it is, that has been the person to whom we owe a tremendous amount for all of this activity. And I would simply like to thank him personally and on behalf of our community for what he has done in the really seminal work in transforming this laboratory into the sort of laboratory it is today. Eric, thank you very much.